of the hundreds of volunteers at BCFM, we'd like to say welcome and thanks for your continued support.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Uncovered, the secret meeting of the secret rulers of the Western world. Yes, it's been exposed online, the Bilderbergers, a secret meeting in 1 month's time. The BBC are keeping mum, though, because one of the attendees at this meeting is a BBC trustee. Plus, if we vote yes in the referendum next week, is there any chance we'll get a radical mayor for Bristol? Former council officer Craig Clark might fit the bill, and he's here to tell us, if he was mayor, what he'd do to give the city a kick up the backside. And May Day is Tuesday next week, and that's the traditional workers' day, so I'm joined by a former scientist at Bristol University, Mike Levine, who's now retired and part of the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance, to tell us what's in the pipeline. Also, Julian Parry is back to explain his way of clearing up all the bribery and corruption around party funding. What exactly is the rolling referendum? But first, Martin Summers is here for our weekly reconnaissance tour across world politics. Now, Martin, the secret rulers of the world, the Bilderbergers, we've uncovered that they're meeting in the United States in the run-up to the US presidential election at Chantilly, Virginia.
Well, yes. I mean, that's news to me, whether they were meeting at Chantilly, Virginia, but as you know, they meet every year somewhere. So.
In the Western world, usually, I mean, it's in one of the NATO countries. They're also very closely connected with NATO itself. But, I mean, I've done a lot of work and research on the origins of these people. Why is it that, and I've kind of explained it myself by saying we've got a trustee of the BBC going along to this meeting and the BBC not covering it at all?
Yes, well, for many years, as you know, they pretended that the Bilderberg meetings didn't take place at all. But as the result of efforts of people like yourself and your website, Bilderberg.org, I believe, they've had to admit that they do actually meet every year, and they were telling fibs for the previous 20 years about the fact that there were no meetings, and they still have them. And of course, what it is the great and the good get together to decide to try and stitch things up for the coming year, basically.
Well, so we're living in a Western democracy. Why is it that at least one or two of these big news outlets aren't actually going big, putting it on the front page? I mean, you've got the people that control most of the money in the Western world. We're talking about the IMF, the World Bank, a lot of the central banks of European countries,
and
the Federal Reserve.
The
Federal
banks.
Reserve. And, yeah, I mean, that is a private bank, actually, the Federal Reserve. But also royalty. I mean, we're talking about some of the biggest royal, I mean, Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands. We've had British royalty going to these. We've got the Scandinavian royalty
and
going.
And up-and-coming politicians as well, like your Bill Clintons and Tony Blairs get looked over by the big boys at Bilderberg.
The interesting thing for me, though, is why is it that as such as amazing... I mean, if any one of those groups we've just mentioned, including the big business people and the politicians, were together in one place, you'd expect some coverage of it by the press, but there's all of them in the same place
at
the same time.
If they've got the press inside the tent, then there isn't going to be coverage, is there? Although The Guardian did cover it last year, as you know.
Charlie Skelton does cover it for The Guardian online. But ultimately, it's very difficult, isn't it, to cover an event when the press aren't even allowed near the place.
Well, also, I think it's extremely... I mean, basically, if the big bad boys want to get together privately, like your Murdochs and what have you, nobody can stop them. But what I resent is elected politicians turning up and then telling us that they didn't go.
Well, not only that...
What's going on there? They are our employees.
Not only that.
And if they're going to a meeting, I want it minuted and I want to know what was going on.
Well, Osborne was the last meeting in St Moritz last year in Switzerland with his Treasury team.
Yes, he turned up and said, I went as a private individual, but I've just taken all these civil servants with me. Now, if he's taken his civil servants with him. It's not a private meeting. I want to see the minutes.
Also, Marcus Agius, who's been in real big trouble today in a separate story, or maybe connected story, as the chairman of Barclays Bank. He's also a trustee, or at least was a little while ago, anyway, within the last year, of the BBC. Marcus Agius is, he's actually one of these Bilderbergers too. So it does make you wonder whether he's using his power and pressure within the BBC to divert them away from covering it.
Well, that's got to be the suspicion, hasn't it? And Rupert, if the BBC don't like those kind of allegations from Bristol Community Radio, it's for them to broadcast the opposite.
Rupert Murdoch's general manager is another from News International, and News Corp is another regular attendee at these meetings. But ultimately, Martin, do you think that there's really any way that these kind of things can be exposed? And what do you think's really going on behind closed doors in
We are exposing them, as you just said.
Well, I mean, I'm talking to a wider audience.
Well,
really.
I mean, in the modern days of the internet, word gets around.
I can tell you the last actual meeting I went to a Bilderberg conference was over in Belgium, and there happened to be a guy there from the European Parliament who was friendly with a former editor of a national newspaper in Belgium. Now, what he did was he got in touch with his newspaper and said, I want you to run a story on this, and it was on the front page on the Saturday of the conference, and on the later in the day of the Saturday, the whole of the Belgian press were there. So it's almost as if only a tiny little thing needs to happen and they will get massive coverage for these meetings.
Yeah, I think the game's up for Bilderberg as a conference, and what they're actually going to have to do is they'll have to make their plots in the Trilateral Commission or some other... there's a whole network of these organisations. Bilderberg is only one.
You were talking about the Brookings Institute, weren't you, and their involvement?
Yeah, the Brookings Institute, yes. Which Path to Persia, which lays out the plan for the war plan for Iran. It's all there. They've got their own internal documents, and everything is totally leaky these days, and if people are paying attention, then you can pick up what's going on.
Well,
you're not going to get it from the mainstream media.
The last time that the Bilderberg conference happened in the US was just in the run-up to Barack Obama's victorious election. But the interesting thing about it was that the announcement that Hillary Clinton would be stepping down to become to move to the State Department and letting Barack Obama fight the election was just 1 week after the conference.
Surprise, surprise. Lots of things like that tend to happen after Bilderberg conferences.
Now, so we may have a big announcement about the US presidential race the week after this meeting, which is happening in just about exactly a month's time, as this is where the West Democratic decisions are really announced behind closed doors. Also, this is right next to the headquarters of the CIA, Martin, this place in the Westfield Marriott Hotel in Chantilly, Virginia.
Well, all facilities laid on then.
And
hot and cold running prostitutes like in Colombia, eh?
And also the next door to the National Security Agency. We hardly ever hear about them, but they're our equivalent to GCHQ, aren't they?
They're much bigger than GCHQ. There's an awful lot of secret stuff goes on which people don't know the acronyms for, but it's out there and it's costing the taxpayer a lot of money.
Okay, well, let's hope there's a bit more mainstream coverage, press coverage of the Bilderberg meeting. We can't say that conclusively is where it's happening, but it certainly looks, the indications are that it's booked over that weekend from the 31st of May to the 3rd of June, which, of course, is Diamond Jubilee weekend.
Presumably
well.
More information about this on your Bilderberg website.
You will find it there, and you'll also find it spreading around the internet bit by bit, hopefully surrounding the Bilderbergers. On to our next global story, and that is Breivik uniting Zionism and Nazism. Now, this is a very interesting article about the Anders Behring Breivik trial, the far-right terrorist who killed 77 people in Norway last year. But the interesting thing is that, and this is provided by Torstein Vidal, who we had an interview with him on here towards the end of last year about all this. Particularly interesting was the parallel exercises that have been going on within, which we certainly hadn't heard about, within Norway. And Breivik, he points out, tries to use the term counter-jihad as much as possible in his evidence at this court case, rather than Zionism, which is actually what he really supports. And he succeeded in having sold this bogus counter-jihad term to the Norwegian mainstream media. To quote, though, from the terrorist himself's manifesto, "So let us fight together with Israel, with our Zionist brothers, against all anti-Zionists, against all cultural Marxists and multiculturalists." What does he really mean, Martin, by Zionists?
Well, I mean, you'd better ask Breivik what he means by it. I think Torstein Vidal, of course, who actually works for the UN in Norway and is a colleague of ours, he's pointing out that an awful lot of the what's going on is this this idea that's suggesting this guy's acted on his own. Now, in actual fact, what Breivik is trying to say, I didn't act on my own. I'm part of a structure where I met English Defence League people, met people from the Knights Templars here in Britain, blah, blah, blah. And he's being allowed to say all this, but the prosecution, for some reason, are suggesting that he's acted on his own. Also, of course, as Thorstein points out in the article, there were some pretty amazing instances of police snafu, 27, according to one commentator, but a lot more if you look closely.
Now, what does that mean? What is a snafu?
Situation normal, all somethinged up. Yeah, but this is Bristol Community Radio.
Okay.
Now, what Thorstein is suggesting there is that Norwegian secret services may be implicated in running this guy. In other words, you know, there may be a Gladio-style operation going on here. Those who listen to this show frequently will know what Gladio's about. It's about Western intelligence service terrorism.
Well, one thing, certainly, he was allowed to get hold of...
historically documented.
He was allowed to get hold of loads and loads of chemicals and other materials which are needed to make explosives.
Yes.
And questions were asked, but nothing was actually done.
Yes, and he was under observation at the time. I mean, we asked these questions. Maybe he is just a random nutter. Maybe he isn't, because he killed, what is it, 67 Labour Party young Labour Party activists. It's definitely a political hit. The question is, who pulled Breivik's strings? Does it run back to the English Defence League in this country? Does it run back to the CIA? Who knows? Who knows? But these are the questions that sensible people ask about these kind
of things.
Well,
one thing's absolutely certain is Breivik was over in Britain in 2002 meeting up with some of the people that founded the English Defence League.
Indeed. So are the English Defence League random fascist terrorists or somebody pulling their strings? Perhaps somebody in Tel Aviv might be pulling their strings. Perhaps the police ought to be looking into it. What do you think?
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, words cannot hide the true plight of the people of Bahrain. Now, this is the Formula One race that went ahead last weekend, Martin. We saw, I don't know if you saw Channel 4 News during the week, but their foreign affairs editor was actually arrested and manhandled. His driver was beaten and possibly tortured as well, and then he was ejected from the country. This is just simply for reporting what was going on in the villages on the outskirts of the main cities of Bahrain where this Formula One race was taking place.
Well, yes, and why aren't we arming the rebels? And then they could blow up Formula One and create an incident, and then when they try to arrest them, we'll have the RAF in to back the rebels. That's what we're doing in Syria. That's what we did in Libya. Surely we should be backing the Bahraini rebels and supplying them with weaponry. I mean, I just can't understand this two-faced attitude. We put all Arab tyrants up against the wall, don't we? We don't negotiate. It's up against the wall time for all Arab tyrants, isn't it?
But Martin,
I must get carried away there.
Bernie Ecclestone, he's saying that also that John Yates is a highly respected copper. He takes his word for it that actually it's all, everything's hunky-dory over
so
there.
So John Yates, the guy who's left the Metropolitan Police in disgrace, is now running the police in Bahrain.
Well, there was going to be an internal inquiry into
him. Maybe what we should be doing is training the people he's fighting to put a car bomb under his car in the morning. You know, we don't mess around with Arab dictators, do we? We didn't mess around with Gaddafi. We're not messing around with Assad. King of Bahrain's got to die, and his allies. That includes John Yates, doesn't it? Perhaps we should send him to Northern Ireland and get blown up there. What about it?
Yeah, but Martin, this is not the way that things are done, surely.
No, of course.
And also, why would I mean that is the sort of thing that happened certainly to Colonel Gaddafi. So what's the difference with Bahrain?
Bahrain, they're our sons of whatever. Yeah, Bahrain is absolutely crucial for this war drive on Iran. The US Fifth Fleet is based there. Bahrain was a British colony until 1971, and then it was handed over to the Al Khalifa family to run on behalf of the British and the Americans and the Saudis, of course. The Saudis came over the border into Bahrain, just as Saddam Hussein came over the border into Kuwait. But did we do anything to stop them? No. We supplied them with all the weaponry they need to come.
They were invited in.
By the Al Khalifa family. But Saddam Hussein claimed he was invited by somebody in Kuwait as well. They always do. Hitler claimed he was invited into Poland. It's a usual strategy. Now, in actual fact, I don't believe in violence in Bahrain, and I'm not encouraging the opposition there to adopt violent tactics. That would be counterproductive. But I'm making a point about the hypocrisy of the West, which is fomenting violence across the Middle East and then going home for a nice cup of tea. And maybe somebody like John Yates needs his guts spread all over the place so his family cry and understand what is really at stake when we're playing these silly games.
Well, that's... I mean, surely, you know, you say you're not advocating violence.
No, I'm not. I'm just pointing out the inconsistencies in the approach of the British government.
Amnesty International say that no one should be under any illusion that the country's human rights crisis is over. The authorities are trying to portray the country as being on the road to reform, but we continue to receive reports of torture, use of unnecessary and excessive force against protests. Also, it's worth mentioning, as the Formula One were involved, that Max Mosley, who used to run Formula One with Bernie Ecclestone until Mr. Todd came along and Max Mosley stepped down, he actually stood in Salford East for the British Union of Fascists in the 1964 general election, and yet the BBC roll him out on Question Time quite regularly.
Well, I mean, he's entitled to his views and we're entitled to ours. Formula One has always been very well connected with the rich and powerful. Think about Mark Thatcher. These people, basically, they travel the world doing what they do. They earn a lot of money for it. But maybe they do need to run into a few car bombs. Maybe they do. Maybe that's the only language they understand, just like Colonel Gaddafi.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
A little bit closer to home and a more democratic country, that is to say, France. Martin, there's been some announcements this week, haven't there, about what's happening with the election. It looks as if it's going to be a runoff between Sarkozy and Hollande.
Well, it is going to be a runoff between Sarkozy and Hollande. And we will see how the cookie crumbles.
One of the certainly one big publication, that is The Economist magazine, has weighed in, though. And this is a little bit of a discussion which took place on France 24, which is the English language French channel.
The front cover of The Economist calls him the rather dangerous Monsieur Hollande. What this is about is the fact that he said to the City of London, to investors, I'm not dangerous, I'm not part of the anti-capitalist leftist fringe that wants to siphon away all public money. The Economist actually thinks he is very dangerous, especially for European finances. They're very scathing of him in this article. They go so far as to say that if the magazine had a vote, they would vote for Sarkozy and not him, just to keep him out of any sphere of influence. They've really not pulled any punches when they say that this man is a danger for European finance.
So if Hollande does get elected, he's a danger for European finance, Martin.
Well, that's just a banker's ramp, isn't it? I mean, basically, at some point, the democratic process has to prevail over the needs of the oligarchy, whatever the cost.
Yeah, but this is The Economist, a very well-respected and balanced magazine.
Well, it's The Economist that represents the interests of the wealthy classes, those people, the 1%.
So what's going to happen then if, between these two? Is Hollande have more support, or does Sarkozy?
Well, I mean, I think Hollande is probably going to win. That's what people are predicting, because Sarkozy has basically annoyed so many people. And then he will have a very difficult row to hoe. He will want to do good things for the people of France, and there'll be all sorts of other people telling him he can't.
He won't have any kind of real power, surely, because they're in the euro.
No, but I mean, they can start...
Economically, he won't.
He's a bit, yeah, but France is influential in the euro. So the first thing he'll do is go and see Angela Merkel in Germany and say, look, we've got to stop this austerity drive. She's wetting her pants about that prospect, I can assure you.
OK, Martin. And also, another story we're going to look at now is when you were on Points West on Monday, you were actually pipped at the post. Even though the Prime Minister was in Bristol, the editors of the BBC Points West decided there was a much more important story which came up before you. And this is about this Gloucester bomber, how he met Bin Laden. A West-born extremist reveals the link, a terror plotter reveals a link to Bin Laden. The would-be shoe bomber Sajid Badat has publicly revealed he met Osama Bin Laden. The Gloucester-born jihadist said he had met Bin Laden more than once in Afghanistan during the trial of a man accused of planning a terror plot attack in New York. In a videotaped deposition made public for the first time, Badat, who was convicted of an aborted shoe bombing mission, admitted meeting with Bin Laden in 1999. So it does seem that, you know, the BBC have come up with some pretty hard evidence there that we've got jihadists in our midst.
Yes, and as it also points out, but British authorities announced this week that in 2009 a judge secretly reduced Badat's sentence from 13 to 11 years to reward him for his cooperation in terror investigations. In other words, he's one of their agents. Now, this is the whole question that people have got to grasp when we're talking about wars on terror. There are people who are patsies, there are people who are moles, and there are people who are technicians, and those who listen to this show will understand what we're talking about.
So what's a patsy, first of all?
A patsy is somebody who is drawn in to terrorism by being recruited by somebody, but is not necessarily realising who they're being recruited by.
Okay, a mole? What's a mole?
A mole is one of the real perpetrators of terrorism. Probably somebody at the Bilderberg meeting.
The moles
are the perpetrators, the patsies get the blame, the technicians are the people who plant the bombs, and they're usually people like Blackwater.
So at the end of the day, an event happens which appears to have been done by someone that actually it wasn't done by.
Yes, indeed. And in Belfast, they understand all this terribly well, but in Bristol, sometimes it's a bit hard to get the message over. People need to understand that most of what you're being told about terrorism is a pack of lies from start to finish.
So what's really going on?
Well, we don't know, do we? And that's what we've got a police force for. That's why the Police Service of Northern Ireland has been reformed, because they were fed up with the RUC being implicated in terrorism. And that's what's got to happen right across the board. Proper police officers get to the bottom. And if it turns out that the security forces are responsible, they've got to face the music.
Well, that would be very nice, wouldn't it? But it does seem that there's a few problems with the anti-terrorist police, particularly at the Met, Martin.
Well, indeed. And that just because police are corrupt doesn't mean that other police shouldn't be chasing the corrupt police. I'm afraid that's the way the world works.
But, I mean, if you've ever seen the Sweeney, I mean, you know, what happens is you're in the middle of an investigation and someone comes along and takes you off it. They say it's these guys' job to do that.
Well,
get away from
it. If we can't do it through a legal method, then we'll have to use illegal methods, like in Libya and Syria, where you can no longer rely on the state. People take up weaponry and fight for their rights, don't they? That's the way it's done. So it's one or the other, proper police action or terrorism. Make your minds up, folks.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Right, after that fighting talk, it's time to calm down a little bit, and I'm joined by Mike Levine from Bristol District Anti-Cuts Alliance. Hi, Mike. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hello.
Now, Mike, can you just tell us a little bit, first of all, about yourself? Because you worked at Barts Hospital, didn't you, as a medical physics sciences?
Physics, yeah. I was in Barts Hospital, yeah.
What were you doing?
Well, I was teaching and I was doing research in respiration, really.
Okay. Now, what's your, how did you get into this whole Anti-Cuts Alliance thing then?
Well, when they started the Anti-Cuts Alliance, I joined up with a little group which was a subgroup of it, which is to do with the National Health Service. So it's mostly people who've been in the National Health Service who are in it now. And what we've done, really, is to put together a booklet which tries to tell people what's actually being done in the National Health Service. That is, stuff that's in the public record.
Okay, so what is being done? Just cut to the chase. What's actually going on right now?
Well, the thing that seems to be being done is to open up the National Health Service to private providers. In other words, trying to marketize the health service. Virgin and other healthcare companies are entering into the National Health Service. So, and it's been going on for quite a long time.
Yes, it was started under the Labour government, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so what stage are we at now, though?
Well, the preparations for privatisation are important because they've happened already before the bill. So there's the private finance initiative where North Bristol Hospital at Southmead has been built under a private finance initiative, which means that they get a private company to build the hospital.
Well, that's Carillion, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And then they lease the premises to the National Health Service. And then there's this thing called foundation trusts, which means that University Hospital Bristol is a foundation trust. That means that they're free to take their own decisions. They can tender for services from outside companies. They can sell off and buy property. They can make deals with decisions on their own about what they do with the funds. Makes it more like a commercial organisation.
Now, one of the things I noticed, and you've produced rather a nice little leaflet here, it's called The Privatisation of the NHS. It can be stopped if people know what is happening. There's a picture of one of the hospitals in the city centre for sale on the front there, and this has been produced by the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance. And Mike, one of the things you point out in here, which actually catches my eye, is that the amount of money actually available to pay for local NHS treatment is being reduced. So where is that extra money going?
Well, the government has said that they want £20 billion taken off the budget of the national budget for the health service. So that has to be done, first of all.
Okay, so that's just a basic cut in the
amount. One-fifth.
Right. And whereabouts, there's still further money coming off, is there, for this privatisation?
Well, yes, they have to pay the private companies for about 30 years. The deals are done for about 30 years. So they lease the services from these private companies, and they have to pay quite a lot every year.
Now, one of the arguments which is constantly put in favour of this is that it puts the power into the hands of GPs and other individual doctors. Surely that's a good thing.
Yeah, that's right. That's what they're saying. They're saying that the GPs will have the power to do it. First of all, that's been changed. There are going to be what they call commissioning support groups, which are much further up the chain, who will tell them who they can... we don't quite know what their powers are going to be. It'll tell them who they can commission services for and from and things like that. But we don't really know what the structure is. The thing is that the GPs won't actually have all the power. But the basic thing is that if the money is reduced and this 20 billion is taken off, it's going to cost about 3 billion to do all the reorganisation. That's what the government... This is all stuff off... openly accessible stuff in the newspapers or on the websites, the government websites. So there'll be less money. So the GPs will be the people who will have to be saying to people, well, you can't really get this treatment for a long time, but you can go private. And they'll have to recommend private services to their patients. So the GPs will willy-nilly, because they want to do the best for their patients. They want to treat their patients by any means that they can.
But surely that's okay. If people can afford to go private, that's fine.
If they can afford it, you see. The point is that medical treatment is extremely expensive. If you have to have a serious, especially terminal illness, some of the treatments are extremely expensive. And the whole point of the National Health Service is that they spread the risk. That, in other words, we all pay all the time, because we know that one day we're going to have to use the National Health Service. And if we need the access to a machine that costs £100,000 or a surgical team that costs huge amounts, we'll be able to get that. Whereas if we had to pay the full cost ourselves, even quite rich people, it's a disaster for them.
The other thing which does bother me, I must say, about the changes going on with the NHS at the moment is that the health minister will not have the legal responsibility to provide adequate, equal and free healthcare to the whole population. That's a sort of universal service of the National Health Service. Do you think I'm right in pointing that out as quite an important change?
That is one of the big things that all the discussions in Parliament and in the House of Lords, where lots and lots of the Royal Colleges and the nurses and the unions have all been pointing this out, and that's one of the big points they have made, and that means that you have nobody that you can sue. You might be able to go to your local...
So you're talking about when things go wrong?
When things go wrong, you'll have to... Or you go and you complain to your MP or to your local councillor, and he says, well, that's up to the local commissioning group, and the Minister of Health doesn't actually have that responsibility.
Okay, so what is actually happening with May Day? Because we're all coming up to the big week for the sort of workers' movement, and the 1st of May is on Tuesday next week, isn't it?
That's right. So the 1st of May, people will be at work. There is I think there is planned to have a demonstration, but and it would be lovely if everybody walked out of work and went on that, because that was the traditional idea of May Day. But the thing is being organised on the Saturday, and people are gathering at 11 o'clock at College Green, and there'll be speeches, and then there'll be a circular march through the town, a parade with union banners and so on. And so that'll be on and it'll be last for a couple of hours, I should imagine.
And the slogan is defend the NHS.
And the major concern of this particular, or the focus of this May Day march will be defend the NHS. Yes, we'll be giving out our booklets, there'll be stalls, and there'll be unions, health unions and things.
So there's not a lot happening on actually Tuesday, May the 1st itself, although I do notice on the Bristol Anti-Cuts Alliance website, which is www.bristolanticutsalliance.org.uk, that there is a meeting at 3 p.m. by the fountains in the centre to raise people's consciousness about May Day. There'll be stalls, leaflets, talks and some fun and food as well. So can you just remind us about the bigger event? What time's that taking place, and when does it start?
11 o'clock at Castle Green.
When, first of all?
Oh, on the 5th.
That's the 5th of May, which is the Saturday.
No, sorry, College Green, sorry.
On College Green, on the Saturday. At what time?
11 o'clock.
And what's happening then?
Well, there'll be some speeches, and then there'll be a parade where people will walk behind the union banners and so on through town, through Broadmead, and then round back to College Green.
So thanks very much, Mike. Martin, you know, we've seen some pretty lacklustre May Days in Bristol over past years. What are your thoughts about the plans for this one?
Well, I think, as Mike says, when people on Tuesday, a lot of people are working on Tuesday, so Saturday is a much better chance for them to demonstrate. And this is their opportunity to demonstrate their opposition to what's being done to the National Health Service, as we've just been debating.
Ultimately, Martin, what do you think are the real reasons for what's happening to the National Health Service right now?
It's just ideology by central government. They've made up their mind that this is the best way to do it. They've forgotten the old conservative adage, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, as we prepare to vote in a week's time on Thursday the 3rd of May, should Bristol have a mayor? Is the proposal driven by a pragmatism or elitism? I'm joined by Craig Clark. Hi, Craig. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony. How are you?
I'm fine. Now, first of all, you're putting yourself forward as a prospective mayoral candidate should they vote go yes next week. Why is that?
Because I don't really want a rich person doing it. I've already stated that I'd do it for minimum wage. And that isn't a sign that I can't do it. That is a sign that I worked in the council as an officer for about 18 months. I've got a good education, and I've been working on this for about 10 years, ever since I came back to Bristol, with the plan to actually see, because I knew the mayoral thing would come up eventually in Bristol.
Well, it's been bubbling along for a long time, hasn't it? I mean, yep. George Ferguson, I can remember 5 years ago being talked about, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful if George was mayor? But the Evening Post never mentioned that he's part of this elite organisation of the super rich called the Merchant Venturers.
Well, this is what I was quite surprised that the people aren't aware of, to be honest. You know, I mean, I'm sorry, but if you're made rich by the place where you live, like Bristol or something like that, I don't think that anyone's really got a mandate to then go out and say it's wrong. Do you see what I mean? The city's obviously wrong. How is it wrong when you've managed to make your wealth from it? And so why is it now you're all saying it's wrong and now you've got to go back and do it? What do you want to make more money?
Martin, I see you nodding there. I mean, well, you know,
I think those are good points. I mean, I'm actually opposed to having a mayor,
I'm pretty much getting that way myself, really. Yeah, I mean, to be honest, if it's going to be a rich person, then yeah.
Well, yes, I mean, what I feel is we're being bumped into this by central government. Yep. What they're hoping is we'll get Carol Vodum, Mr. Ranson, somebody in pocket with the Merchant Ventures, and then they can move ahead with all these development projects, which have been blocked by the boring old democracy of the city for years, because boring old democracy is a bit slow moving.
But Craig, I've got you in here as a yes candidate, and you're now telling me that you're having doubts. But ultimately,
no, I'm not.
Ultimately, if they do vote yes, you will be standing.
Yes.
What will the powers? What will your powers be if you're elected?
Well,
mayor?
This is what I find amusing. Everyone seems to think that the mayor is going to have these massive powers, and you're not going to have massive powers as a mayor, because you are going to be accountable to the people and the councillors there. Now, for example, we've got a split in the council of about 35 Liberals, 30 Labour, and about 14 Conservatives with 2 Greens. Now, if you think one person can go in there and try to challenge those 70 different people with differing opinions and try to get something through easily, unless they're obviously a little bit influenced by perhaps people with a lot more money than the people that are in the council, then I don't think they're going to have a massive amount of power. My way in which I would do this is, I've already put this in a letter to David Cameron when I thanked him. I don't know whether you've read it. It is available online because it's part of the minutes that were at yesterday's cabinet meeting, the final one of Barbara Jank, which was quite nice. And nice to put this letter forward. And what I was doing in that is stating that I'd like to have to split it balanced. The cabinet that I would put up would be 2 Liberals, 2...
So first of all, one power is you choose the cabinet.
But the thing is the cabinet, okay, we have a 35 to 30 to 14. So therefore, by maths, you go, that's 2 people for the Liberals, that's 2 people for the Labour, and 1 for the Conservatives. I can't bring the Greens in because they've got 2 candidates, but I would like the Greens to be...
Well, they will have more than 2 candidates in future, certainly.
Possibly, yeah.
They've got 2 members at the moment. I mean, surely the whole principle of the mayor is that the mayor can basically wade in to the bureaucracy if it looks like something should happen and isn't happening, and basically knock heads together and say, we're going to do this and we're going to do it my way, rather than allow now your committees or whatever to decide.
No, I don't believe that way works. What I believe the way works is I'm a peacemaker. I always have been. I've always tried to sit in the middle about two opposing positions to try to get a deal. I don't want to be responsible for all the decisions going on in Bristol City at all. What I want to be able to do is there's decisions to be made and they will be opposed by various different people. I want to get those people around the table and I will be the arbitrator or the chair or whatever it requires for those two people to start and get an agreement. Once that agreement is got, then you have the mandate and then you get everybody on board. The problem if you go driving in, blaring, going, well, we're doing it this way, a bit like Boris in London, you know, just throwing everything out the tank. What people don't realise is he splits people right down the middle. And instead of getting everyone working, he's getting half the people working, and then the other half are trying to stop it happening because they didn't want it in the first place. Now, the point is to get everybody.
Isn't that
on
called
board.
Divide and rule, I think?
I think it's called divide and rule. I don't know. I would imagine so.
Anyway, look, you've had 18 months, as you said, as a council officer. What has that taught you about the way the council really works?
Well, in my letter to David Cameron, I did highlight very quickly that I was pretty shocked when I first got into the council because of the pace of the work within the council. Now, I came from private sector, and basically,
what were you doing beforehand then?
Before then, I was working with Sainsbury's on their home delivery service in Bristol. It was a pilot scheme, first one in the country. It was hellish.
Okay.
And so basically, I went into the council and I got an hour dinner break for the first time in my life. I got
So you don't like that then?
I just think that the difference between the private sector and the public sector was so severe that I had to leave after 18 months because if I carried on, I wouldn't have been employable within the private sector anymore because I would have slowed down so much because I already knew I was slowing down. I did 2.5 people's jobs when I was in Bristol City Council because I was so bored. And I told my boss when people were elevated to other areas within the council, I didn't need a replacement.
Well, it sounds to me like you're saying what the Lib Dem councillor Tim Leeman said on here last week, which was that really the city council should be run like a business.
Well, it is a business. It's a corporation. This is the problem. But everyone thinks that it's sort of this public thing.
But people are paying tax in order to keep it going. It's not just surely like an ordinary business.
No, it's
you wouldn't
like
pay your tax to Sainsbury's, would you?
No, but the points I'm trying to get at is you know how long it takes to administer a meeting and get the papers out and things like that. In the private business, you've got to get it done right there and then because everything moves quicker. And basically, in the council, the process is so slow that what happens if good ideas come forward in the private sector, what happens is everyone gets on board and they push it through as quickly as you can because then you get everybody enjoying being part of a new idea and everything else like that. In the council, the process is so slow that any good ideas that come through, by the time that they actually fruit, everyone's so bored of doing it.
So you're saying that in a way that good ideas to a big bureaucracy like Bristol City Council can actually be a threat to some people?
Oh, I put forward the option in October for the council to take on free labour to sort out their derelict properties in Bristol. Free labour, okay? And they turned it down. Now, how, as a business, even as something that's trying to save the taxpayer money, I was bringing in people prepared to work voluntarily to bring houses back online so people could use them. And I got a no.
Well, this is funny, isn't it? Because isn't this weird, Martin? Because we had a little thing on earlier on about exactly this. This is about Bristol North Baths, where several people, including a guy called Justin, who we had on the programme here, he's taken over Bristol North Baths in exasperation because it's 7 years it's been allowed to fall to pieces.
Yeah.
And he's doing it for free. He's doing security in there and he's doing the place up.
Yeah.
So what is the resistance within the council to this kind of obvious, seems to be an obviously sensible idea?
Well, as you know, if I was offering free labour, then the people that currently do that work within the council wouldn't have a job.
Yeah, but there's nobody doing the work, for example, at Bristol North Baths. It's had no security for 7 years. It's just been boarded up.
Yeah, well, this is the fun thing. I asked the Lord Mayor, Peter Abraham, when he was Lord Mayor some years ago, to simply put out in the press that, you know, what Bristol needs is the private sector landlords to come forward and make sure that they're able to open up their doors to people on housing benefit, because they weren't at that time and the homelessness situation was going through the roof. And the problem that I got from Mr. Abraham at that time was he just turned back to me and said, I can't do that. And I said, all I'm asking you to do is ask in the press. That's it. That's all I want you to do. And he said, I can't do that. And, you know, to be honest, Craig, he said to me, you should be a bit more selfish. You shouldn't need to be worrying about these kinds of things. What are you worried about? And I, at that point, lost my rag completely because I don't even understand the concept of selfishness. But this is the Lord Mayor of Bristol telling me not to be more selfish.
Okay, someone has worked as a council officer. Yeah. What's your view then of the sort of balance between the power of our elected representatives and the officers? Because, of course, nobody elects them.
Well, that's a very interesting point. There are nicknames for the councillors that the officers give them. I won't go into details about what they are.
I wish you would.
Well, one of them is the incredible invisible man. He's no longer a councillor, he's an MP. So you could probably work that one out if you wanted to. And I find it's very, it's like the private school sort of mentality within that, unfortunately, in certain sectors, particularly the higher up you get towards those that are controlling the law, the finance and the money. Do you see what I mean? And it basically, what it becomes to is you're either part of their club or you're not part of their club. I wasn't part of their club. I never have been because I was state educated, thank God. And basically, what I'm trying to get people to understand is that we have to work with these people anyway. These are the people that are going to get done it. And what's so funny, have you got the mayoral, have you seen the mayoral leaflet that's gone round? Have you noticed in there that it states that the officers make the majority of the decisions within Bristol City Council?
Martin.
Well, I'm a former officer in Bristol City Council, and I agree with some of what you're saying. I think your belief that everybody can be persuaded to get on board is trying to take the politics out of politics. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, there are different interests, and people, you know, different interests are represented in different political parties. And sometimes you can get everybody together, like in Northern Ireland, the Northern Ireland Executive has got everybody in it for obvious reasons, because before they got everybody in it, it was a mess. But I mean, ultimately, for example, my vision for Bristol as a Labour activist would not be the same as Peter Abraham's.
Right.
And ultimately, they're not necessarily compatible, which is why you have elections. But either Peter wins them or we win them, and then whoever's won is allowed to proceed. You know.
I think you're missing the point of politics, and this is the problem that we've got with the police and everybody else like that. Everybody thinks in politics that they're there for their ideas. No, they're not. What they're there for is to facilitate the ability of the people, the normal people of Bristol or wherever, for their ideas to be put forward. Not, I don't elect anyone. I vote for the person that I think can facilitate best. If I have a problem where I am, can I go to them? Can I speak to them? Are they going to sort it out? That's what I vote for, because that's their job. I'm not voting because they've got an idea. The last thing I want is a politician with an idea.
No, I think I agree with you that we should be what people are looking for is politicians who are able to do deals. You know, because obviously what you've got is the adversarial system that we've had in this country, like Labour-Tory classically.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, we're in the batting or they're bowling or we're batting and they're bowling. Now, obviously, with a more subtle system like you've developed in Ireland, everybody gets to elect people and then they have to do deals.
That's right.
And I used to work with a guy in the Polish Parliament who's a Polish MP for Polish Socialist Party, and they've got lots of small parties. So they spend a lot of time doing deals.
But on
the other hand, you can't always get everybody on board for everything.
No.
For example, you might want to push through something like building load of council houses in Bristol. Lots of people want it, but some people, the property owning classes, would say, no, we're not wanting it. They've got to be outvoted sometimes, you know.
But again, the basis of politics is majority rule. And if you have majority rule, if you've got the majority mandate, you should be able to push it through. That's what gives it authority.
Until the next election when we change and they get their turn to
Craig, I want to put one particular point to you. Don't you think maybe that this whole mayoral election thing will be fine for a year or two and then we'll just get a rich fat cat in?
Well, this is what frightens me and why I'm standing. I'm not rich and I never will be.
Ultimately, you see, you know, the idea of having maybe someone like George Ferguson might be very popular, but see, after a while, you'll sort of start getting vested in interest, getting their eye on the job years before an election even comes up. And obviously, people with a lot of money are going to stand a lot more chance of getting those roles.
Well, I always try and get this across to people. The only people that can stop anyone who's going in with money is the people that vote. So if you're going to go and vote, If you want a rich person to run Bristol, vote George Ferguson. If you want another rich person to vote Peter Abraham. If you want somebody else rich, Simon Cook. You can, you know, if you want someone rich, vote for those people, because that's what you will get. If you want somebody who's normal and, you know, is basically isn't rich, then you can vote for somebody else. I'm standing, hopefully, on behalf of the Peace Party, which is a small organisation at the moment, but basically we want peace. I'm fed up of the warring and the arguments and everything else that's going on across the globe and in my home and everything else like that, because people are fed up with the wars going on and everything and the money and the costs. And all I want to do is say, look, you've got a chance to vote for peace. Let's give it a try, see what happens.
Okay, final comment I want to hear. What are you going to do about parking, for example? This one big thing in St. Paul's is basically a big parking lot for people that work in the city centre. What are you going to do about that?
Well, I am absolutely so annoyed with the people that don't live in the city chewing up our roads and not paying
for it. So we're going to have residents parking in St. Paul's, are we?
I will put forward the fact that if you do not live in Bristol and you want to park on the road, you're going to have to pay, I'm afraid.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Craig Clark. And the vote is all up to you. And it's next Thursday, so thanks very much for joining us, Craig.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
I'm joined now by Somerset businessman Julian Parry. Now, last time you were here, Julian, you talked briefly about the rolling referendum. Do you want to go a bit further into that, please?
Well, hello, everybody, and thank you for the opportunity. The rolling referendum is my solution to the huge problem we have in politics today of the lobbyists and the deals behind closed doors, which, as opposed to what the last speaker was talking about, he's talking about deals that are done in the open. We are all concerned about the deals that are done behind closed doors for the benefit of the few. I look at today's financial situation, and I can't help paraphrasing Churchill by saying, never before in the annals of human commerce has so much been owed by so many to so few. And I don't think it's any accident that we've got to that point in life, because there's not enough control on the politicians to make sure there's an even playing field.
Okay, so far, Martin, do you agree with Julian on this stuff?
Yep, I agree with all that so far.
Okay.
Fine. But the question is, what do we do about it? Well, Dominic Sandbrook in the Daily Mail, 20th of April, headlined Ferdinand Mount's new book on the subject. Ferdinand Mount has written a very good book called The New Few, or A Very British Oligarchy, which Dominic Sandbrook paraphrases as bankers drowning in money, out-of-touch politicians, unaccountable quangocrats, not for generations of those who run Britain have been so far removed from the common man. Now, Sir Christopher Kelly has recently reported his findings on the funding of political parties and has come to much the same conclusion. He believes that the major political parties should be publicly funded. And if we care to look upon the whole thing on the basis of he who pays the piper calls the tune, then I think I would agree with him. The man is absolutely right. The only problem is, how do you disperse the funds that are allocated in a fair, transparent and open manner? And I think I've found just the way, and it's called the rolling referendum. Now, the way this would work is quite simple. 6 points to it. For any political party to be funded under this scheme, that party must have at least one elected Member of Parliament. If you don't do it that way, everybody's got their hand out. The government party and official opposition would be forced to take public funding and be expressly banned from taking both public and private funding at the same time, whereas all the other parties could take both. Each year, the Electoral Commission would put a proposal before Parliament for three levels of party funding. The funding scheme to be adopted in any financial year would then be chosen upon a free vote of all members of Parliament, and the Treasury would then provide the chosen funding to the Electoral Commission out of general taxation. The Electoral Commission would now distribute those funds to the qualifying political parties. Where no preference was expressed by individual voters, the funds would be simply distributed upon the basis of the votes cast, not upon the basis of the seats obtained. However, it would be open to all registered voters at any time to advise the Electoral Commission of the party to which they wish their part of the funding to be allocated.
So what you're essentially saying is that individuals could at any point switch where their party funding was going from. Even so, what do you do? You go online or something and you say, I want my funding this week to go to the Tories.
Absolutely.
I want my funding this week to go to Labour.
Absolutely. And this could be achieved either online or by filling in a form obtained from the post office.
And sending off an old-fashioned snail mail letter.
A snail mail letter.
So anyway, Julian, before you go through all that, because we haven't got time to go through it all, what do you think, what chances that there are, and what kind of allies have you got in actually getting this thing through?
Well,
it certainly seems to make a lot of sense to me.
Well, the great thing is, just let me finish last two really important points, is that when ministers put forward bad policies, they would suddenly find their money not just disappearing, but actually going to their political rivals. So, because everybody would have an opportunity to write on the form or online exactly why they were shifting their funds. So there would be feedback, and government would know what the public really thought of them in real time. And the final point to make is that if at any time the government party finds itself obtaining, say, less than 20% of the political pot, then it will be open to the Electoral Commission, or required of the Electoral Commission. They go to Her Majesty the Queen and point out that the government has lost the popular mandate, and she would now be now open to her under the law to consider whether or not she dissolves Parliament. That will be a matter entirely for Her Majesty, and she may decide that she wants to hear about it two or three times before she does the dirty deed. But that is a clamp then on politicians running away. At the moment, all we've got is we can vote them in once every 5 years. It's not democracy. It's what Hailsham called elective dictatorship.
Now, we've got a situation this week with Jeremy Hunt, the Culture Secretary, who's quite clearly been batting for Murdoch and really got no integrity left as a minister, and yet he still refuses to resign. So wouldn't that happen in your system too?
Well, I think in this particular instance, everybody could be voting him out by moving their money and telling the Electoral Commission they're moving their money because Mr. Hunt is still in post. And oops, look, the government party is now getting less than 20% of the annual pot. And heavens, Your Majesty, says the Electoral Commission, is it perhaps time to throw them all out?
Well, certainly Martin's been nodding, giving it the thumbs up. Where can we go to find out more about this rolling referendum then, Julian?
Well, we've only just kicking it off. I must confess that at the moment we're presenting it to UKIP to see if they want to bring it in as part of their election pledges. Now, obviously, it's got to go to Lord Monckton, who controls policy within the party, and we will see how
that
we do.
That doesn't sound very democratic.
Well, you know, they all have to have their systems. I'm sure it's
I suppose it's in between UKIP conferences is the only time that he does this sort of thing.
Well, the real point is that we've got to have a system, that a political party that is dedicated to referendum is the only party that's actually going to vote for this. Because otherwise, a lot of them are going to say it's going to like asking turkeys to vote for Christmas.
Okay, Martin, is it a goer?
I agree with the idea of state funding of political parties, but also, as a realist, I think sometimes political leaders have to tell their followers things they don't want to hear. For example, I'm thinking of Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness telling the Republican voters, look, we're going to have to go for a peace process here. And they could have been destabilised by their supporters deciding to pull the plug on them. And you've got to give some scope for political leaders to make a judgment that they're going to tell their own people things they don't want to hear. And then, of course, be justified. Because, of course, what you do is you have it after every election, you dish out the money till the next election. That's the way they do it in Scandinavia.
But I'm going to give you the final word, Julian.
Well, I'm thinking of it being dished out once a month and not just dished out on block. That's point number one. And point number two is it means that we will have to have politicians who can really explain their policies to their flock. And sometimes they do have to make difficult decisions, but the political skill is the art of the possible, and it will be up to those politicians to prove that they were up to the job.
Okay, Julian Parry, Somerset businessman, thanks very much. That's all the serious talk, though, out of the way now, because Friday night is music night. 2 hours live with Pat Hart and the Fresh Blood Party Boys, followed by the UFO show. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Ron Stone, Labour councillor for St George West. Also to Mike Levine from Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance, to prospective mayoral candidate Craig Clark, and as you just heard there, to Somerset businessman Julian Parry, and of course to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Next week, how can Newsnight's new political editor Allegra Stratton be impartial when she's signed a book deal to write all about the wonder of the Miliband brothers? The editor of the Somerset-based BBC Bias blog will be along to explain all. Every BCFM show is available online. Just go to bcfm.org.uk, or even easier, thisweek.org.uk takes you straight to this show and our archives. A podcast of this show is online usually about 10 minutes after broadcast. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. And now, do please join us on Friday Drive Time for 5 o'clock next week. Don't let the banksters get you down. I'll leave you with Bob Dylan. But his show left here in style. By the way, that's a cute hat, and it smiles so hard to resist. But what's a sweetheart like you doing in a dump like this? You know, I once knew a woman who looked like you. She wanted a whole man, not just a half. She used to call me sweet daddy when I was only a child. You kind of remind me of her when you laugh. In order to deal in this game, got to make the queen disappear. It's done with a flick of the wrist. What's a sweetheart like you do?